On this episode of Complicated Conversations, we welcome back Allison Winscotch. Allison is the New York Times bestselling author of 9 novels, including Cleo McDougall, Regrets Nothing, In 20 Years, and Time of My Life. She lives in Los Angeles with her family and their 2 rescue dogs, Hugo and Mr. Peanut. Her 10th novel, Take 2, Birdie Maxwell, is out now. Welcome back to Pop Fiction Women, Allison.
So happy to be here.
Oh, we're so excited about this one. We're excited about all of your books, but this one for real. Like,
thank you.
So good. So good. It just hit the right time, the right notes, everything. We love it.
Thank you so much. As we talked about off camera, that means so much to me, particularly this time around. So, I mean, it's always good to hear nice things.
Yeah, right.
It really means a lot to me. So thank you very much.
Yeah.
Do you want to give our listeners the elevator pitch for Take 2, Birdie Maxwell?
Sure. So it stars Birdie Maxwell, stars because she is sort of Hollywood's most famous actress who has been canceled, and she returns home to her hometown and finds an anonymous love letter that was sent to her from one of her exes. And she decides that the best way to get back into America's good graces is to track down who wrote this and sort of invent her own rom-com to make them root for her again. So, and she sets out in
just a great premise.
Rickety RV with an old crush, and hijinks happen from there.
They do ensue, yes.
Yes,
they do. Ensue. And the premise is one that I absolutely love. I've always had it in my head that I wanted to write a novel about going back and exploring your past loves. And I even was like, had chats with my friends about it. It would be awesome if it was like a Netflix show, which yours should be a show, where you get in an RV and you road trip. So you have done it. You have executed what I always wanted to write. And of course, the journey that I had in mind was really, of course, always about the protagonist journey. Like, what is she learning about herself more than it's about, you know, all these exes she meets along the way. So you've not only written it, you've executed it brilliantly. And we both are huge fans. But it's in no small part to your star, your lead here, Birdie. She's amazing. As you said, we love Birdie. She is America's sweetheart. But as you said, her life is in shambles. She comes home disgraced. She finds this anonymous love letter. And she tries to reality show her way out of this mess searching.
I haven't heard that reality show. That's exactly what she tries to do.
Right?
Exactly.
That's what she's trying to do, so she can, you know, go on the search for the one that got away. The plan, you know, gets added on to, which we'll come back to. But we want to start with Birdie and what inspired her as this sort of fallen actress, fallen from grace for you.
Well, first of all, I appreciate that so much that you guys loved her. I feel like we might have discussed this when the Rewind came out. I have a tendency to write unlikable women because I gravitate sort of to, I don't know, like sort of bitchy women. Like that's my vibe. I like women who have a little edge. And
yes,
writing Birdie, she does have some edge and she is complicated, but I tried really hard to make her winning because I think with this type of book, that's just the key to getting a reader on board with the journey that she's about to go on to. So, you know, I know that Corinne and I talked about this a little bit offline, but this went through many iterations. And she started off, her name was Toby, and she was a romance writer. And, like, through a variety of reasons, I was steering away from an actress because I tend to often write about celebrities. There's always a celebrity in my book. And I was like, oh, I want to try something new. But it turned out that this was really the best way to tell this story with somebody who was famous and had this fall from grace. So sometimes you just have to write what comes easily to you. And that's when eventually I settled on this character. And I liked this notion of her. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of rom-coms that take place when somebody goes home to their hometown and has to sort of reassess everything. But I liked that she was a fish out of water in high school, really, you know, struggled to be anything other than this drama nerd, as said, with love. no disparagement.
Yeah, of course, of course.
And I like that there was this situationship with her best friend's brother. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was just sort of threw all those things into the mix and then tried to sort out how I was going to resolve all of that. So,
yeah. Well, there is something about that premise or that character that we've seen before, right? We've seen whether it was Katherine Heigl, for reasons that are not fair, we've seen women being taken down from a pedestal for being human, for having their own emotions and lives. And when someone else wants them to just be really simple, really straightforward, always a smile, always a yes. And so this was very familiar in a way, even though it didn't feel like anything we'd seen before, it was familiar enough. Like, oh yeah, I've seen women being put through this gamut before.
Yeah. And I should say, I mean, I should clarify that a little bit just since I didn't get too much into that. She has had sort of this public meltdown, which for many of us was justifiable, sort of based on the sexism situation on set.
Yeah.
And it was a little tricky because I obviously wrote this post sort of Me Too, and you would like to think that all of this has been resolved in the world, but it hasn't been. And, you know, we're obviously as women still up against sort of this latent misogyny all the time. And so I didn't want to make this like a feminist diatribe, even though I would love to write that. But I did just want to sort of infuse it with some things that we still face. And you know, as you said, I feel like I still see this daily, like even by the time this comes out, even with Taylor Swift, like people are like, like there's still so much sexism baked in, particularly for very successful women, that I felt like that was the launching pad that I could sort of have her push up against. So even if she's about it in a misguided way, I mean,
her human.
Yeah.
And she's taking a stand and speaking out for, you know, something that's not right. I mean, she's not
as we all know, that does not always.
I know. Exactly.
Those are the very things they shut you down for.
Yeah. You're just supposed to smile and take it and deal with it calmly offline, whatever that means. Well, another magical piece of this novel is Elliot. As you've talked about a little bit, the situationship with Birdie's best friend, Mona's brother.
Right.
And his life, first of all, we love him. And his life isn't in shambles yet, but he's kind of hanging by a thread.
Right.
So you really gave us something to root for with him, more than just being this complication for Birdie. He really has his own point of view. He gets his own chapters, and he really has his own process that he has to go through, and Birdie's half-baked plan is completed by him, which I also love, right? So because he needs it as well, and you know that he's invested not just in the idea, but just he's invested because he needs something too. So tell us about Elliot.
So that was also a balancing act where, you know, in some of the earlier drafts, maybe it felt like he was using her, even though he cared about her, or there was a version where it wasn't about his career. But just like Birdie, I tried to make him multifaceted so that he has a couple balls in play here. He still has feelings for her. He does need this for his career. He told his twin sister, Mona, that nothing would ever happen with Birdie. They have a secret. And I do think the key to some of these rom-coms is keeping so many balls in the air that it's not like a mystery for the readers, but you still, even if you know that there's going to be a happily ever after, that there are still some questions that arise along the way. And I think that is what makes a really interesting rom-com, that it's not just like 2 + 2 = 4. It's like, okay, well, we know it's going to be 4, but maybe it's going to be like 1.5 + 2.5 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make him 3-dimensional and not just like the handsome guy.
Yeah. He's both.
Yeah, he is. But
yes.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
We need that too. But that's exactly why I think this works so well. And it's one of the things I love in a rom-com is when the male character also has his own arc, or as you say, is juggling a lot of things too. I mean, it adds another dimension. And to me, that's also realistic. I mean, you know, each person is usually working on something or working through something themselves. And to give the complexity to both characters, I think.
Right.
Really,
and I
really
say, like, as
worked.
Sort of alluding to what I said before, like, as feminist as I am, I love great men. Like, I love men who are supportive and root for you. And I mean, there's a reason why we're like, we're all swept up in the Travis Kelce of it. You know, they're, I'm not interested in just writing like a supporting male, even though my primary interest is in complicated women, you know. So I tried really hard to have him jump off the page as well.
Yeah.
Well, and let it be said that you can do both. I mean, that's what makes this book so exceptional, is that we are really invested in them as a couple and them individually. It just makes it so much more rewarding to read about. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you. I really thank you guys.
So we read in your acknowledgments that there's a little real life inspiration here, that you've received a letter similar to Birdie, but clearly you did not have the same, I shouldn't say clearly,
no,
but your acknowledgments note that you did not have the same reaction as Birdie. So tell us about that.
I love this.
It's funny. I think I must have repressed this because it was only partially through writing this, where I was like, oh my God. So I think the summer between my junior and senior year in college, I was home. I grew up in Seattle. And this was back when, like, we actually all opened our mail because email didn't exist. And I got a letter, like this flowery fawning, it was written in cursive, anonymous letter. And I actually found it very creepy. Like, it was so weird. That I remember sort of tucking it back in the envelope and being like, okay, that's like not, I don't even want to
bury that.
Yeah, like it felt almost stalkerish. And so nothing ever came of that. But I do think there's sort of this like romanticized version of being like this anonymous suitor. But actually, when you think about it, it could be a little creepy, which is what I found it to be at the time. And I have no idea who that man is. I assume. So I did get an anonymous love letter 30 years ago or 25 years ago.
Did you store it in the back of your head and think this could be the seed of a story someday?
You know,
because the other thing is, it's Birdie finds it at a time when it suits her to find it, right? Because otherwise, if she was really happy and everything was going really well, she might have put it back in the envelope and been like, ooh, stalker.
That's
here, it's so believable because she needs. This gets wheels turning. Yes.
Right. She was desperate for that redemption arc. I mean, that's actually a super smart point. It probably was nothing that interested me at the time because I was, attached. And I assume it came from somebody at college. Again, this was just all my presumption at the time and what I still assume. And I had a college boyfriend, so I assume it was just somebody who was, I don't know, didn't have the nerve to come up to me at some party at college and be like, I have a crush on you or whatever. But maybe I tucked it away. I don't know. It was one of those things where, like, now when I think about it, I can really viscerally remember, like, standing in my parents' kitchen, going through my mom being like, this is for you, opening it up. But I don't know that I think it was like really tucked away because it was, again, it's one of those things where I was like, wow, this is like, it wasn't like, oh, I like you. It was like cursive written, like the oceans are dividing in your, whatever, or whatever it was. Like one of those things where you're like, oh, no, no, that's a mess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They call that the ick now, right?
Yeah.
Like, no, this is whatever, even. So maybe that is, as you know, I wanted to ask you about astrology if you're interested in that. But like you sort of pull things from your past that maybe you're not even aware of. So that is.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's kind of lodges there until you're ready to use it for whatever you need to use it for.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So we've already been gushing about this book and how much we love it. But again, in your acknowledgement, or was it in your author's note, this is a problem child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was a problem.
For you. Tell us about that. And when you thought about giving up on it and why you didn't and how you kept going.
So for the listeners, I write in my acknowledgments that this book went through many, many drafts. And when I say drafts, not even like reworking chapters, I mean starting over from zero, probably 5 times. And, you know, I am a writer. I mean, you guys have interviewed a lot of people. Corinne, I know you right now, and Kate, you as well. Like, I really need to have that bolt of an idea. And once I do, I can write very quickly. But without it, it's like treading water for me. Like I just barely managing to stay with my head above the water. I'm just sort of directionless when I have like a half-baked idea. So
yeah,
I love a second chance romance. I knew I wanted to do that and I was under contract. So I had a time constraint that I just had to start. And this is just my thing. I just don't write well under those circumstances. So you know, as I said, I initially started with a romance novelist who didn't believe in love. And she would, anyway, I'm not even going to take you through all the different ways that I tried to. I said, I tried not to make this an actress because I have done that. But once I was just like, you know what? I just need to do what is going to work for the book. And I allowed myself to write what I knew, you know, would serve the story, then it became much easier. So it was sort of me getting in my own way for a while. And then
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I do think writers can do that. Like we want to,
absolutely.
You know, whether it's like, you never want to repeat yourself, which I try not to do. Or, you know, you feel like you have to be writing some great literary work or whatever it is. We do get in our own way, and that's really what it was. It was just my own doing, my own frustration, and sort of the pressure I was putting on myself. And once I just was like, you know what, I know how to write this, just do it, then it became much easier. So, and then, you know, the Elliot, initially chapters weren't told from his perspective. Like he really brought a lot to it because he, as we discussed, has his own story. So it really is completely different than where it started. And I'm so grateful to my publisher and to my editor for just being patient with me. So
yeah,
that's,
yeah.
That's,
and then when it clicked, did you know, were you like after the fifth,
I got it now? Like you guys liked it.
No.
I do think that when a book is really hard to write, ideally readers have no idea. That is the dream scenario. They do not see the work that has gone into it. But a writer, it can be difficult to distance yourself from the relationship that you had with it. It's not that, like, it's so funny. Whenever I would, like, have to reread the book, as you guys know, like, when you publish a book, you have to reread it, like, 1,000 times. And it just becomes excruciating. Yeah. Like, even now, in the draft that I'm working on, I'm like, oh, I can't believe I have to read this again. But I would,
again,
as we were getting into it, I would like send my agent and editor notes like, actually, I really like this book, but I have a difficult time separating how difficult it was for me to do the work. So when I read it fresh, I really liked it, but it, you know, like any relationship, as you said, problem child, you still are sort of like, wow, you were like a massive pain in the ass. And that's, you know. So that's how I feel about it. But I love her. I love Elliot. And I'm very proud of the book. I just have a different behind the scenes take on it.
Right.
But it doesn't make sense. That readers feel that way, which is the dream.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, mission
and
accomplished.
I just say one more thing, that I have written books that I have thought were so easy and loved to death, and not everybody loved them. And that's, you know. So
it really is a separate thing than the receiving of it, than the reading of it. And that's hard. But this one's going in your favor.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. It is the work that goes into the book is, in an ideal world, totally different than the reader experience if you have really pulled it off. And so, yeah. You know, that's what I'm hoping for. And again, there are books that I think all authors have written that have just flowed out of us seamlessly, and readers haven't necessarily responded to them in the same way that we do as writers. So I think there really is a difference between, you know, the work that goes into it and what gets published on the page.
For better or for worse.
Yeah, for better or for worse. That's right. It doesn't always go on the page.
That's right.
Well, I don't know if the siblings played a role in your various iterations of this, but in the final, we love Bertie's sister Andy and Elliot's sister Mona. They really play pivotal roles in the novels and in the siblings' lives. I mean, they don't, again, it's complicated. It's not just like, oh, we're best friends. I mean, you know, they have a complicated sibling relationship. I don't know any other kind of sibling relationship myself, so... But they're ultimately trying to do what's best for their siblings, for each other. So tell us why you wanted to explore the sibling relationships.
So starting with Andy, Bertie's sister, I really love this idea that you can be as successful or as famous as possible, and the people who grew up with you just do not care. And I think that that is actually pretty accurate. I live in LA, like, you know, famous people are sort of in your orbit. And it just becomes like, okay, well, that's your job. Like, we're not impressed. I don't mean like me and a celebrity, but I think that that is the vibe. So I thought it was really interesting to have her come home and Bertie sort of had to drop all of her BS. Like, because Andy is like, you're super annoying. You've abandoned me here while our parents are off doing, you know, whatever on the sabbatical. And she just doesn't care. But they find a way to root for each other by the end. And I really love, I love reading that. I love writing that. I think family can be very complicated. But if you love each other, that's sort of the underlying, you know, you step up when you need to. And then Mona and Elliot are twins. And I thought it was fun to explore that he was always a little better at everything than she was in many ways. And the dynamic of that. I have two kids, really different strengths, sort of mirroring each other. And they're not twins, but it leads to both amazing support and also like really heated arguments. Because, you know, they can sort of pick apart each other's weaknesses, but also appreciate the other's strengths. So I thought that it was an interesting thing to examine where, you know, he's like this popular jock and she's, you know, she stays home and abandons like her dream of, you know, sort of becoming an astrophysicist to run this dive bar and drive around in an RV. So it was just... I don't know. I like examining family a lot.
What I loved about Mona, I hope this doesn't give anything away, but everyone else is putting their expectations on her, but she knows what she wants to do and how she's happy. And she's not out there looking, she's not missing anything. She really knows. I love that piece of it.
Thank you. I mean, I think that's something that sort of getting back to the feminism of it, like, meet people where they are. Like, she doesn't have to go work for NASA. And she's just like, this is me. I'm totally happy. You know, get off my back about it. And he is really the ambitious one who doesn't necessarily understand her. So that is, you know, where they have to find their common ground. And I also, you know, I like the fact that Bertie was hers. They were best friends. Elliot was the crush, but Bertie was hers. And I also understood that as well. You know, whether it's romantic or not, like we all have sort of territorial feelings about certain people in our lives. And Mona had territorial feelings about Bertie. Not romantic, but, you know.
Yeah.
So, which I understood because Elliot had everything in high school. So.
Everything. I was just going to say, she wanted this one thing. Like, you got all the things. Let me have my one thing.
And I needed to establish that to sort of set up a realistic obstacle, because I do think that there are times you're like, you know what, that's off limits. And, you know, I whatever, and when I was younger, unmarried, like, you don't hook up with your best friend's ex or whatever it is. There are boundaries there.
Yeah.
And so that was an important thing to establish.
So this novel has a component with the search for love for Birdie's professional life, but also in her personal life. But it's also about Birdie's search for her own agency, her own narrative. I love the ending. I'm not going to give it away, but you use those words, agency and narrative, so much throughout the novel. And you would think Birdie's this world famous actress. She has a platform that she can, you know, post every day. And you'd think, like, she should have direct access to her own narrative, to her own life. And yet we know right from the start, maybe even when she gets that first role and she's inaccurately pegged as being from the Pacific Northwest, she just has lost it the whole time. And if anything, she's just then cultivating what she's already put forth, and that's not real. And, you know, that part of the journey was so important to the story and just really resonated with me, and I know with Kate too. So
thank you.
Tell us about that part of the journey, because this isn't just about, it's such a layered discovery for her.
Yeah. You know, for young women who already know everything about themselves and their agency and their voice and their power, I say bravo. Truly. But as I have gotten older, and I would say particularly into my 40s, I discovered that there were a lot of things that I could still grow towards and with. And that was something that I find really interesting about, I think, particularly in this moment of time where women are, a lot of us, sort of stepping into our power and taking more control of our own narratives, which I know you said, you know, is a big word, but it is not something that is necessarily easy, even if you're famous or professionally successful. Yeah. I think in some ways, when you are successful or famous, I mean, I'm not a celebrity, but I think it is almost easier to go with where the tide takes you. Because you mess anything up, like, oh, you're like, oh, I'm well paid, I, you know, blah blah blah. It is harder to sit down and sort of have a reckoning with yourself about where you still need to make changes or where you've gone wrong and where you need to go right. So I find that just really interesting, whether it's in a romantic comedy, whether it's in wherever I'm reading it, or if I'm writing it myself. And as I said, I do feel like probably in the past decade, I have made a lot of changes in terms of my own autonomy, whether it's speaking out for things that I believe in, whether it's, I don't know, just like telling my husband, like, you can't say that anymore. Like, whatever it is, I'm throwing him under the bus. But like, he literally said something the other day. I was like, no, you're a man. You can't say it. So just, you know, things like that where I feel like, maybe at this time in my life, like we all thought we would be grown-ups and know everything because we're the people in charge now, but we're not. And
no,
like, what's the point in being alive if you're not going to keep sort of evolving? So that's what I was interested in with her, where change can still happen no matter your fame, no matter your success, no matter your marital status, whatever. So I find that really interesting.
Oh, same.
Yes.
Yeah.
Same. We can keep rewriting our story, and we should.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I feel like, you know, like, I don't know when this will air, but we just saw Super Bowl, and like, even somebody like J-Lo, who...
Oh, I was just going to say this.
Yeah. I mean, she's in her 50s, and I have such admiration for her work ethic, but she has been down, she has been up, she has been through marriages. Mm-hmm. Whatever, she is still reinventing herself, and I find that so interesting.
Same.
When you were talking, I was just thinking about that, because Corinne and I were talking offline about it, her new interview with Zane Lowe and this new musical movie she's putting out. But the whole point of it is, she's like, I've done a lot of work, I've grown, I've changed. Yep. This is a journey of self-love. This isn't about, it's a second chance romance. Everybody's heard about me and Ben. This is about me.
Correct.
Dealing with my shit, falling back in love with myself, looking at myself. I mean, it's a total like self journey here. 100%. So whatever age and whoever you are, go for it.
100%. And I find that so interesting. Like, I am not interested in being friends with women who they're not interested.
They're like, I'm good.
Which isn't to say like my friends aren't amazing. I just mean like the change is what keeps us interesting in our own lives. Right. So, you know, certainly am not the person I was in my 20s, even though I love that person. But like, what, you know,
part of this is another thing that jumped out at me as a theme of forgiveness in the novel. I mean, it's a topic that I struggle with personally, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
And Birdie has to reckon with. And, you know, she writes, "We all do stupid things when we are young. Some of us do stupid things even when we're older. The grace of living is that it's never too late for contrition, and it's never too generous to accept that contrition when you can."
Yeah.
And that really, I thought about that. I mean, forgiveness is very complicated, right? The offering of it, the being able to accept it, and then the learning to forgive yourself, which she has to do. You know, she says she has to learn to quiet, you know, the critics in her own mind. And that's possibly the hardest one on this journey is the forgiveness of yourself and the mistakes you've made and who you were. Why did you want to explore that theme as well?
You know, I think having gone through these past, let's say, 6 to 8 years of unrest in the world, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to answer this. I don't necessarily struggle with forgiveness, but I know people who do, and I think generally it is often a waste of energy to harbor resentments. I think it only backfires on yourself, which isn't to say that there's a justifiable reason to be angry or to loathe someone. I have people in my life who I loathe. But I find, just for me personally, I like to compartmentalize things. And if I am still sort of churning over something, that person doesn't know it. It's just me. Like, I'm up at night thinking about it. Yep. I'm resentful. I'm, you know, in a shitty mood. So I try very hard not to hold on to that stuff. But that just happens to be sort of how my brain works, where I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, you're the asshole, not me. I'm moving on. So I think sometimes when I write, and I will say, I do think that my mechanism is healthier than some of my friends or family who hold on to that resentment. Not because like I'm better, it's just how my brain works. So I think when I try to write, I'm trying to present maybe a healthier alternative to the people I know who maybe are still hung up on these grievances or these grudges. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that there is a way to forgive people that still respects yourself. And that's, I think, really important, where you can just say, you know, I'm literally thinking of a specific example in my life where I'm like, I am never going to be friends with you again, ever. I'm not going to like sit here and think about it forever, because that is just going to actually upset me, what went down. But go with God, like move on with your life, but we're done. And I feel like the punishment for that person is I have no interest in your life anymore. So I don't know. Like, I don't know that I was consciously trying to write about forgiveness in like that way, but that is how I approach it. I do not like, it's like the same thing we were talking offline. I don't read reviews anymore because I don't like having something in my life that's going to upset me. You know, that's probably naive, but there's like enough in the world right now that upsets me.
Yeah, exactly. So
like, if I need to just let go of somebody being a jerk to me, then I do. And their punishment is like, I know that they're a jerk. And I don't know. So I don't even know if that answers your question, but that is sort of how I view forgiveness. And that's probably why I wrote her in that way. And other characters who needed to forgive her as well, because she was not old. Yeah. You know, I don't mean to imply like, I'm sure I've been an asshole to somebody in my life too. And they've had to work through forgiveness of me. So, you know, I just wanted to get Birdie to a healthy place where
yes.
I think that holding on to grievances of your past is very, and I don't, I, obviously there are some things that are just egregious and you
right.
you can't let go. I don't mean to minimize that, but mm-hmm. many wrongs that have happened to us,
yeah.
you can't change them. So like yeah. you can't change the mean review. So
yeah.
I don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question, but that is,
yes,
that is probably where I was coming from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that goes hand in hand with the evolution and the change.
Yeah.
My part of the question and Kate's part of the question are really the same question, which is if you're not willing to forgive yourself for mistakes, you're not going to grow. You're not going to yeah. change because you're going to be stuck justifying past decisions instead of rewriting a different story that suits mm-hmm. you better.
That's and right. You know, and to that question about forgiveness and change, I have a lot of discussions. I have a 17-year-old daughter with her about boundaries with friends and people who she's very self-confident, like she's very social, but you know, she's a teenage girl and sometimes some bad behavior comes across the radar. And I think that having those boundaries and like, okay, this crossed the line. And that is not acceptable to me as a friend. It's not acceptable to me as a romantic partner, you know, as a sibling, whatever it is, whether it was Birdie or Mona or Ian or Elliot, any of the characters, I really believe in drawing those boundaries for yourself. And it's not that like you're pushing somebody away, like whether it's your lack of forgiveness or letting them go, it's that you are giving yourself the space by, you know, delineating that boundary around you to figure out what you need. So I think that she does that,
yeah.
Particularly with one ex toward the mm-hmm. end, and other characters yeah. do that for her. And I think that's healthy. That's, you know, that's as it should be.
Yes.
So.
Well, Allison, Kate and I are both lawyers, but you have an MBA from the esteemed Wharton School of Business with a concentration in marketing.
I did not get my MBA. It was just part of my undergrad. Yeah, I can't claim that.
Well, you can claim it. Just, not. So yeah. My author idols, like you, like Emily Giffen, Ellen Hildebrand, are both business-minded and creative. In the same package, because it's a creative endeavor to sell books, right? That's just how it goes. So I think your strength especially is in your ideas. Your premise always hooks me. I wondered maybe not where your ideas come from, but how do you know that the idea is the idea? You know, you mentioned before that lightning bolt. Do you just wait until you get it? Do you play around with one idea, like twist it around, look at it a different way? Or do you go to another idea until the lightning bolt? How does that work for you?
That's such a good question. So I usually start sort of, I don't know, it's like a recipe. Like you figure out like, okay, I think I want to have a pasta tonight, but I don't know what sort of pasta. So, I often have sort of a very general idea, but when it becomes clarifying is when I figure out usually my heroine, my lead character, which is actually circling back. I hadn't figured that out when I was writing this, and that's probably why it wasn't working. Obviously, I'm, you know, driven by writing interesting women, so that is often the spark, a woman who is going through something. So I have another book coming. Well, the book I'm working on now, we went through so many different ideas and I was up in the middle of the night, as I tend to be at this age. And I was like, wait, why am I not writing about a group of people who are insomniacs? So the book is called The Insomniacs and it's about a group of people find each other in the middle of the night and help solve each other's problems. So for me, that was very much like, wait, that was like literally like 3 a.m. I was like, wait, this is the idea. Like we're all going through this. You know, it's an interesting way to get back into like the idea of reinvention and, you know, all the complications that come with your life. So It is sort of a combination of knowing it's the right idea, like that lightning bolt, but also having a character who I find interesting enough to stick with for 350 pages and those thousands of times of reading the draft. So sort of the, I'm so envious. I have writer friends. I don't know what you guys are like, who have like five different brilliant ideas at once. And I am just like that.
No.
Like every book I write, I'm like, this is definitely the last one. I have no more ideas. So,
And yet this insomnia, we just spoke to Tia Williams, and that's how A Love Song for Ricky Wilde came to her. And I'm like,
she couldn't sleep.
You're really on to something here. And of course, I don't have insomnia, so I feel I'm missing out here.
I would trade places with you in a heartbeat.
But you guys are coming up. Look what's coming out of these bouts of insomnia. You're making it look, like very fertile.
One bout of insomnia.
That's the rare thing in a year, as opposed to every other night when you're just worried and tossing and turning for no productive reason whatsoever.
Well, we have to ask off topic of Birdie, but not of love stories. You wrote an article that went viral about Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. The names have already come up on this conversation already.
Yeah. How could they
not? But the article was amazing. It was about the bigger lessons that we, I think particularly, if I recall, middle-aged women, are taking from this very public relationship. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot more since you wrote that. Obviously, their love story has become, even more
national
fairy tale, with him winning the Super Bowl and her winning the album of the year and all of this. So, tell us what inspired you to write that and sort of what lessons like men and women can be learning from this.
Yeah, so I was actually asked to write that. I had just posted something on Threads about why I thought it was going to work. It was just like a offhand, he's successful. Mm-hmm. He's put something out there knowing he could be rejected anyway. And the editor at Yahoo asked me if I wanted to write it. And I was like, yes. Mm-hmm. Like I was born to write this. So, it has been so interesting to watch. I mean, the larger lesson is, and it's not, I will say, it's not just middle-aged women. Like my daughter is watching this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I said to her the other day, I said, oh, I think he's going to go join her in Australia. And she said to me, I was so not blown away, but I was so amazed by this because I don't think that our generation would have thought this. She said to me, well, yeah, she showed up for him so many times. How fucked up would it be if he didn't show up for her?
If he didn't.
That's where. Yeah. It's fine. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God. I don't know that I would have thought that about a dude when I was 17. Mm-hmm. So
we were just expected to show up for them. And and to whatever extent they did was like a magical bonus. It's a given. Yeah.
Right. So I feel like the model of this relationship has sort of permeated many generations. But, I think the larger lesson is, particularly for millennial and Gen X women, we settled for a lot of guys who, as I said in the article, sort of gave us 65%. And we were like, no, can we please have 70%? And and Taylor did that too. I mean, projecting myself into that, it seemed like I'm watching all these videos from the Super Bowl. I have really been struck by how normal she looks. And I mean, even as the most famous woman, billionaire in the world.
Yes, exactly. Right.
She just looks super happy and she looks super normal. And I don't feel that we have really ever seen her looking that way for many, many years. And so, I think the lesson is we all deserve a guy who is going to give us 100%. And that doesn't mean it's all storybook, happily, everything is picture perfect. But I do think that, I can certainly speak to myself. I settled for guys who made me feel like it was my fault that they didn't want to, give me everything. And that is a very easy thing to believe and internalize. And I think suspect that Taylor was also made to feel that way. Again, don't know.
Bejeweled. The lyrics. Yeah. Just listen to the lyrics for Bejeweled.
That's exactly right. So, which I've seen people say is actually her real breakup song, which I agree with. Because she's like, you know, I am a jewel. I'm going out tonight. So,
exactly.
I, you know, that was sort of the crux of the article. And I, beyond that, it's been super fun to bond with my daughter over this whole thing and just enjoy it. It's a nice thing in this world. So people who hate it, they don't even understand.
I know. Oh, yeah.
You know,
that we can't even go there. That's
talk
just
about
too
things
much.
That you're wasting your energy on. Like,
oh my God. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Exactly.
For what? For
real
what reason?
Problems. Can you not care about Taylor Swift? Like, come on.
And I don't know if you've seen, I love whatever's the real men that are coming out of this conversation. Like, I don't know if you saw Shaq was like, if I met Taylor and got to shake her hand to take a picture with her,
with greatness,
would be my brush with greatness. And how amazing would that be? I'm like, exactly. Thank you. People would say that about Shaq all day long. And yet, that feels revolutionary.
The Taylor of it, you know, I wrote in the article, my daughter has been a fan since she was little, and we've gone to sort of every show since she was old enough to appreciate a show, starting with Red. And I have always felt that she is an excellent role model. And it's not like you need your kids to have like celebrity role models or whatever, but kids idolize celebrities. So that is what it is. And for men now to, like, we had my husband, he watched the movie with us. I mean, he didn't come to the Eras tour with us. I was like, yeah, we don't need to spend that much money on your ticket. You're not going
to appreciate it.
But it has been, you know, again, like circling back to my feminist feelings, it has been really an amazing thing to watch her power sort of come together. She has demanded that the world appreciate her, from like people like my daughter to people like Shaq. And I think it is really laudable and cool and respectable. So, and it, let me say,
it's so good. Like I said,
Elliot, props to Travis Kelce, because he is not at all intimidated by it. He appreciates her. Like, as you saw those videos after the Super Bowl, he's like, oh my God, thank you for your support. Thank you for coming. Like, it wasn't about him. He was appreciating her. And that's why we were all
traveled across the world.
Like,
yeah. You know? Yes. Yeah, and I think you said she looks so normal at that. Mm-hmm. I would say too, she just looks really comfortable. Like, like she's being genuinely herself.
Correct.
And that's not easy with, you know, every freaking eyeball on you, and with the scrutiny that she gets. And she does. She looks like really comfortable.
That's right. She looks like you see them like in the corner of a nightclub, and they're just like two people hanging out. And, you know, it's also been interesting to see, as I mean, I don't know how deep a dive you've done, but like everywhere she goes, she is like flanked by two bodyguards. And I'm thinking, I'm like in this chat on Instagram, like, what a difficult life. Like, she cannot, like, they're literally like pressed up against her because
everybody
wants to get to her. So that she has found this sliver of normalcy with some, you know, dude, he's very good at his job and he's famous in his own right, but they just seem normal and comfortable. And, you know, I don't envy her life, actually. It looks difficult.
No.
So,
But what I love is, like Birdie, that it is, you can tell it's just as much Taylor being sure of herself as it truly is their love, too. I mean, their love takes her to another level as well, without diminishing. She'd do it without him, but when that she has him is even more, I don't know, sparkling or, love that. I love it. Allison, what else are you loving? What else are you loving right now, as we wrap this conversation up? So any shows you're watching, books you're reading?
So, well, I'm about to start your book. I'm so excited. I like opened it last night on my Kindle, and then I'm
dying.
Variety of things. So I'm very excited for that. I like literally since 2016, I like watch a sitcom every night. Because it's like the only way that I can sort of unwind. In fact, my husband made me watch this like murder documentary the other night. And I was like, I haven't done this in 8 years. I'm not going to sleep at all tonight. I'm so annoyed. And it I mean, it was fine, but whatever. So I just, okay, first of all, if you haven't seen BBC Ghosts, it's excellent.
Okay.
CBS remade the show here, which I have not seen because I don't pay for Paramount or see the CBS app, I guess. But it is delightful. I'm about to watch season 5. I think it's the last show. And then a couple nights ago, I could not find anything to watch. And I had seen proof that advertising works, a billboard for a show called like Not Dead Yet, I think, with Gina Rodriguez. And it's about.
Okay.
It's so cute. Like, I was like, this is not going to be very good. It is so adorable. And the writing is really sharp. And I like can't wait to get into bed and watch it tonight. So that is what I'm watching.
Good stuff.
Yeah. And what that did is. I just, you know what? I just read something really good, but I read on my Kindle like you, and I feel like I can't remember.
What was it?
Oh my gosh. Wait, I'm going to see if it's on my, what have you guys, I'm going to ask you what you've been watching that you like while I pull this up.
I have just started the Truman Capote and the Swans.
Oh, wow.
That feud. Oh, boy. It is Naomi Watts. I mean, Calista Flockhart, Molly Ringwald. Everyone is in it. Diane Lane. And let me tell you, I was a little bit eye-rolly at that. I was like, oh, they just guzzled in the star power because there's nothing to it. Oh, it's
really
so
good.
It's really good. It is really good. It is.
I found the book. Sorry, it was Shark.
Yes.
It's Red Shark.
We love that.
We love that.
We interviewed her. She's amazing.
Yeah. Yes. She is.
How did somebody conceive of this? I'm going to have to go listen to that interview. It blew me away. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That incredible. Is a good one.
Yeah. So.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for joining us again. We love chatting with you. And
yes, to read your book. Take 2, Birdie Maxwell.
Yes.
Everybody get this.
Oh, it's so good.
Thank you guys. I really appreciate this so much.